Welcome to another edition of Garden Talk. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Oh, you hear that? We have a very large live audience for today's show, and I'm really, really happy for it. And we have guests for you. As you listen into the show today, I hope you'll call in because we've got a couple of guests to start the show to answer questions about indoor or outdoor plants. Welcoming back Bruce Spangenberg, the UW Extension Horticulture Educator for Iron County. Bruce, good to have you back.
Nice to be here.
And with us for the first time is Erica Hanekel. She is the author, former professor of environmental history at Northland College. And Erica, great to have you with us for the first time.
Thanks so much, Larry. It's going to be fun.
It's going to be a lot of fun. And as we move along today, I do hope you'll join in with your questions as well. Our live audience, folks will be raising their hands. But you can call if you're listening in. Easy to do. Call 800-642-1234. It's 800-642-1234. Or you can email us to talk@wpr.org. That's talk@wpr.org. Bruce, Erica, I want to hear a bit more about your professional backgrounds. Bruce, you're closest to me, so we'll start with you. You're a transplant from our neighbor of the South, Illinois. What'd you do there?
Actually, I'm not a train. I worked there, but I lived in Wisconsin.
Good.
I crossed the border every day. Most of my career was in Illinois. I actually had retired a few years ago and then was looking for something to do horticulture-wise, and this opportunity came along in Iron County with UW Extension. But I had been with University of Illinois Extension in Northern Illinois, the Northern Counties. I started in a county job in McHenry County, and then I was a regional horticulture educator across almost the northern third of the state. And then second half of my career, I was the horticulture department chair and instructor at McHenry County College in Crystal Lake, Illinois. So I taught credit courses, you know, advised students, ran the program, that kind of thing.
So a lot of experience there. And Erica, you certainly had a lot of experience too. Talk about your work in environmental history. I found that very fascinating.
Sure, yeah. So my gardening credentials, I've been a master gardener here in Wisconsin for 16 years, 15 years maybe.
Yeah.
And I was a professor of environmental history for 16 years mostly within the U.S., talking about humans' interaction with their environment over the long arc of U.S. history. But I also offer classes in agricultural history and horticultural history. I've also written two books. My latest is Orchid Muse. That was perhaps the most fun project that I have ever embarked on in my life. My previous book, my first book, was called Empire of Vines, and it was a history of 19th century wine growing.
Well, you know, and I like the subtitle to that second book, A History of Obsession.
Yes, of orchids, yes. I guess
flowers.
You could obsess about wine, too, but yes.
So as we go along, maybe I'm going to talk with you a little bit more about that obsession, but orchids certainly are on your mind a lot. So orchid questions. Actually, we'll take any question that you have relating to your both indoor and outdoor flowers. Bruce, how's the spring been for growing up here?
The rain is nice.
Yeah?
Yeah, it's been good. I mean, one of the things, though, I think a misconception a lot has happened a lot in questions I've got the last couple months. We had a mild winter, but it actually was pretty harsh on plants because we didn't have snow. We didn't get much moisture at all. So we had a lot of damage going back to last year that carried into winter. So. You know, a nice snow cover protects a lot of things, and you don't have it, you know, you do run into problems. But the spring's been good. We've got rain.
People planting a little earlier?
Yeah, but, you know, we've had how many frost advisories in the last 6 weeks? I mean, it's tempting, but, yeah.
Yeah, I would imagine the flowers are probably okay, but you don't want to be putting your, people were putting their tomatoes and peppers out early. That would not
especially, I mean, you know, March and April were pretty mild and people, you know, you want to get out there and do things, but you really need to, you know, we're okay now, but you know, tomatoes in the first week of May is pretty risky. Peppers in May is pretty risky.
Yeah, I would think so. Well, Erica, lots of gardeners are planting native plants.
Yeah.
Which is really cool. And talk about the benefits of adding natives to your landscape.
Yeah. So for me, I have kind of a long list of my favorite ornamental natives, mm-hmm. because I live on a fairly small plot in town. And so I kind of garden it to the hilt, but I want to combine as many natives as I possibly can to keep our pollinator population up. But I am not exclusive. I mm-hmm. also do other hybridized ornamental plants. I'm kind of a take it all kind of person. For me, the attraction to the bees is kind of number one. I mean, the beauty of the form of particular native plants here in northern Wisconsin as well. So one of my absolute favorites would be bottle gentian. It grows about 3 feet high. I do stake it a bit because it wants to flop, but as long as it's getting enough water and quite a bit of sun, it produces these gorgeous sort of lavender, sort of a bottle worth of flowers mm-hmm. on each thing. And the bees sort of like buzz their cute little butts all the way into and the flower collapses upon them. Oh. And then they come back out. And so you can just sit by it and you just like watch this little town worth of bees that has come to your garden. You know, there's lots of other very beneficial things for it, you know, of course, for soil chemistry and health as well. I mean, of course, swamp milkweed and other types of milkweed, but at least in my garden, the easiest and the most frequented would be swamp milkweed, and those would be for the butterflies, so that is caterpillar food. And then if you add one other plant to somewhere in the vicinity that is not native to here, but it is native to North America, if you add Tithonia, or what's called Mexican sunflower, then what you've got is a lovely kind of a double dip here, because the Tithonia is feeding the actual butterflies, and then they go to the milkweed and lay their eggs, and then the caterpillars eat the milkweed. And so you have a full buffet for the full life cycle of the butterflies there.
You know, I want to jump up and drive over and take a look at your...
Please do. Please do.
It sounds absolutely wonderful. Yeah. So you've given a lot of thought to that.
I try to do some landscaping with perennials or ornamental native perennials. You know, the other ones that are really beautiful to me, I love doll's eyes, or what's called white baneberry. It looks creepy. It is definitely creepy. If you are sort of on the dark side of things, you want to grow doll's eyes for sure. And this is a really good one for partial shade. Because I live in town, I have a whole lot of shade, and so I think a lot more about shade than about sun. But it grows into, I don't know, a 2 or 3 foot bush. And it has beautiful spires of very sort of light, airy, white flowers. But then it produces this bud, or this, it looks like a big seed, which I guess it is, on the end of the sort of panicle of its flowers. And it's just these like bright white sort of berry-looking things with little black eyeballs coming out of it. And so it just looks like this stalk of eyeballs coming at you. My son loves it, but I will say it is also toxic, so you don't want to grow it where small fingers can pick it and would want to put it in their mouths. You probably don't want to grow it around chickens or other pets.
Oh, well, so it would be a problem for birds, too?
I don't think it's a problem for birds, although the birds definitely leave it alone in my yard. I've never had anything come after it.
Yeah, they tend to be smarter than we are when it comes to
yeah,
comes
yeah, to, they do.
to things like that, for sure. Well, Mark had sent us an email and wonders if one or both of you could please name some common riverbank plants distinguishing between good and bad. Well, what do you think, Bruce?
Riverbank as far as what to plant or what to...
I think the person's probably interested in what are some plants we could put along our riverbank, and then what are some we shouldn't put?
Yeah. Well, I think if you stick with the native plant theme, something like little bluestem, you know, wouldn't grow in the water, but would help stabilize the banks. As with most grasses, little bluestem, even big bluestem. You could also go with, if you want to go with a good low maintenance plant, you know, the fragrant sumacs, the low grow sumac in particular, that's only 18 inches high or something, is a good stabilizer. There's always that fine line when you deal with stabilizing soil with plants that do a very good job, but then get into the invasive side, and that's where things like ribbon grass in the past, blue lyme grass is another one that if you go back in time was widely recommended because it had a really aggressive rhizome system that would stabilize the bank. It still had an ornamental value, but now it's no longer legal to sell because it's invasive.
So. Yeah, so stay away from that. Well, talking with Bruce Bagenberg, a UW Extension horticulture educator for Iron County, and Erica Hanekel, who is a master gardener, author, he's got a couple of books out, former professor of environmental history at Northland College. You can join in, audience, as if somebody wants to raise their hand for a question. We've got some. You can join in by phone at 800-642-1234 or email to talk@wpr.org. But let's take a question from the audience. And your name is?
My name is Naomi Wegmeyer. And we have a large organic vegetable garden. It was inundated by grasshoppers last summer. And I am wondering, can I expect the same awful thing this year? Because they were just, I've never seen it like that before.
The short answer is no. You can't really predict from year to year, even though it was terrible last year. You know, same thing with Japanese beetles and other things. So people say, I'm overrun. But a lot of factors can come into play, and the winter is one of them. You know, the fact we had no snow does influence insects, not necessarily in a good way. But the other thing is moisture. You know, grasshoppers tend to thrive better in dry weather. So now we've had a pretty wet start to this season. So what happens with a lot of insect populations, they do have controls. There are natural fungi and bacteria that actually, you know, keep the populations down. But in a dry year, they're not present. So it's anyone's guess. There's really nothing you can do to, ahead of time to prevent them from coming back. You're pretty much at the mercy of the conditions and, the weather, what happens.
There you go. You can join in too. Again, 800-642-1234. Email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to Garden Talk on WPR News. You're listening to Garden Talk on Wisconsin Public Radio News. Larry Mueller here. We're broadcasting from Bayfield, the Bayfield Pavilion for Bayfield in Bloom. We're celebrating that a bit, but certainly we're talking about those flowers and indoor and outdoor. We're taking a look at vegetables. We covered that a little bit too. You can join in. Maybe you've got a question. Number to call is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. And we have a question from the audience.
Hi, my name's Ann Christensen, and I'm from Washburn. And I think it's kind of an insect question, but we have a very small apple and pear orchard, and our best pollinators in early spring are wasps. And they're very friendly wasps. They don't go after you unless you really dig into their nests. And so we welcome them and appreciate them. But my question is, I've heard that they lay their eggs in caterpillars. And so I'm wondering, I hope they're not also laying their eggs in monarch caterpillars, which we try very hard to support.
They might, maybe.
Yeah,
I don't know.
It depends, and that's an excellent question, because there are a number of wasps that are parasitic, and they tend to be very host-specific, so there may be a certain one that does seek out a monarch, but on the other hand, there's others that seek out other pests. But most of these wasps are really, really small, but they are kind of fascinating because they will find their host. And probably the best examples, I'm sure some of you have seen, if you grow tomatoes, you get the tomato hornworm that has these big, that look like eggs, they're white. Those are actually cocoons of the parasitic wasp that are gonna emerge. So if you see that, leave it alone, because that's gonna create another couple dozen wasps to go around and find more hornworms. But the short answer to your question, it's hard to say, because most of those parasitic wasps are very specific to the host that they seek out.
Yeah, and a follow-up?
My name is Stacy Corcoran. I moved up to Ashland last summer, and I moved into a house that had some dying pine trees. We immediately cut them off. We're grinding the stumps down to ground level. So my question is kind of two-faceted. One is, will I ruin everything if I put stump disintegrator on those stumps? And the other question is, if I want to layer material over that so I can make that area plantable, what layers would you recommend?
So you ground the stumps out, or you're...
Two are gone, one is going to go in the next couple of weeks.
Okay. I mean, you're pretty much, you can, you know, add whatever amendments you'd like, level it off, and then plant what you like. There are very few restrictions on replacing plants, or, you know, replanting an area where a tree died or a shrub died or whatever. So I would just make sure whatever's left after they ground out the stump, you add some soil to that, level it off, make sure it's firm, and then just plant, you know, whatever you want to plant in that area. There shouldn't be any lingering concerns.
I wouldn't think so.
I might suggest trying to remove as much of the wood as possible, just because it'll suck the nitrogen out of anything else you try to put there. So if you could dig it out, I don't think the stump disintegrator is going to be a problem, because that's just more of a sort of natural bacteria that's breaking that down. And at least when I have tried that, it doesn't work very fast. And it sounds like you want pretty quick turnover, so it might just be better to just get a shovel and kind of like lift it out of there.
Yeah, good question. You can join in too, 800-642-1234, email to talk@wpr.org. So I want to just go back to last year for a minute. As you saw the end of the season, I mean, how did the season go in northern Wisconsin?
I think the biggest issue was drought. And then the problem with that, a lot of people overlooked that, you know, you look at what happens with plants this spring, you say, well, the winter was mild, we got rain, you know, why did my plant, and we see this with shrubs, we see it with trees, I know a couple growers that have had problems with raspberries too, that they start to leaf out and then they just shrivel up, and you're wondering, well, what happened? Well, a lot of it goes back, with any perennial plant, goes back to the previous year, and if they don't store up enough energy because of drought or because of an insect problem, whatever it might have been, they go into winter weak, and then they need a lot of energy to come out of dormancy in the spring. So a lot of times what happens is there's enough energy to start the bud break, the leaves start to come out, and then the plant literally runs out of energy and it just dries up. So your hope is the roots are still alive, depending on, you know, with raspberries, that's usually the case, but many times with trees or shrubs, you end up with dieback that you have to go in now and prune it out.
Yeah.
In my case, the drought created something that I had never experienced before. So I have many raised beds in my backyard and my front yard for the past 15 years or so. And I had never had root creep from trees around into the raised beds, because I had been watering the raised beds so that my vegetables would grow throughout the drought. And all the maples that are 40, 50 feet away just took over everything. And so we've had to basically excavate the entire bed, pull out all the roots.
And start over?
And, I mean, we put the soil back in, and they might come back, you know, I'm sure they'll come back any other super dry year, hoping for a little more rain this year so they don't invade again quite as quickly.
Where are we on rain this year for northern Wisconsin? We certainly got it in the south.
I think short term, we've caught up, but I'm not sure. If you look at different drought monitors that go back, you know, where are we with 12 months or 18 months? I'm not sure, but I think we're pretty close. It is somewhat localized, though. Sometimes, you know, some of you will say, nothing, you know, we got a little shower, and you talk to someone else a few miles away, and they got, you know, 3/4 of an inch. So it's, some of the showers the last couple of weeks have been pretty spotty with big downpours, and then a few miles away, hardly anything. But I think we're getting back to where we should be. I don't know. There's, you know, you have to look at the total map and see.
Sure. Yeah. We have a question from the audience.
Hi, Jill Barth and Berkey from near River Falls and Hudson. We're visiting here because we have a sailboat at Port Superior. I have an organic blueberry U-pick and used to have a U-dig flower business, my husband and I. My question is, unfortunately, I purchased from a vendor tansy, which is invasive. And I just pulled a bunch of it out at Port Superior in one of the gardens because I don't like it. Although I do like the ornamental aspect of it in the fall when it dries. So is there a friendly, sustainable, organic way to eradicate tansy, or do I just keep on pulling?
I think you hit it on the head, keep on pulling. that's a good, excellent question, because when you deal with plants like that, short of using a systemic herbicide, that, you know, you just, if you're persistent and you keep cutting it, you keep, eventually the plant's going to run out of gas. Like I mentioned, you know, a few minutes ago with plants, every year they have to store up energy for the next year. And unfortunately, some of the invasive species are very good at it, but, you know, you've got rhizomes under there, you've got the crown of the plant, but if you're persistent, it, you know, you will eventually win, but it's going to take some time.
Yeah, pulling it, you're going to leave some. But
yeah, I mean,
pull
it's,
it anyway.
Right. Obviously, you like to pull it out, roots and all, but that's not practical. But if you're persistent and you keep pulling it, it doesn't have leaves to regenerate the energy it's losing. Eventually, you will kill the plant. It's just how long is eventually going to take?
Yeah.
Maybe also deeper mulch, if possible, to both protect the blueberry roots but also smother the tansy.
Yeah, that's a good idea.
Yeah.
Very good idea. We have some more calls from the audience, questions from the audience. Jill's got another person.
Hello.
With a question.
Hello. I live in Ashland, Wisconsin here, and I went to a lovely seed exchange at the library in Washburn, and there was a woman there who had iris seeds, and I was so flabbergasted and I wanted to propagate them, but I didn't know how. Do you have any suggestions and where they would like to live?
That is, I've never done that. have you done that, Erica?
I have not started iris from seed, but I do have a few types of iris. One that is perhaps native, I think, and another that is more ornamental. They're both sort of dwarf varieties, like a foot tall or lower, and they don't want to be planted too deep. The rhizomes really actually like to have heat and sun on them in general, although the dwarf varieties can kind of move in and out of sun. I find mine are in actually partial to fairly serious shade. They also divide politely. I love things that divide politely, right? So you're not gonna have like sweeps and sweeps of them, and they're also very easy to divide because they're running on the top. You just take a sharp shovel, you know, just like crack them off and go give it to a friend or put it somewhere else in your garden.
But starting it from seed.
Yeah, I would think probably fairly thinly because the seeds
right
are quite thin as well, aren't they? They're sort of like papery thin.
I didn't understand how to do it at all.
Yeah.
And I'm not seeing anybody else raising their hand saying, hey, I did that, raised from seed. Let's take another. You know what? Somebody may call. Our calls, give us a call if you got an answer to that question, or If you have another question of your own, at 800-642-1234, and we'll get you on pretty quickly.
We have tansy and lots of it. We have an old pasture land, which has a seed bank from hell. And but when it comes to remove it mechanically, the root is L-shaped. And if you discover what direction the root goes and you pull down, most of the root will come out and it won't return. So if
you want to do a mechanical. I thought you said pansy at
tansy.
First.
Tansy. No, tansy.
Tansies too. Tansy. Okay. Thank you for that advice. Appreciate it very much. And I know we got Amy in Appleton with an email. Amy planted a climbing hydrangea about 4 years ago. It's growing wonderfully, but it's never flowered. It gets afternoon sun and is in a protected area in their front yard. It's gotten so big, moving it to a sunnier spot is no longer an option. Amy can feed it with to help it flower. Phosphorus is usually
right.
The phosphorus right. Is the feeding.
High phosphorus. Anything you can do to increase that sun just even a little bit more, if you could take down some boughs of trees at all.
Or some limbs.
Yeah. I mean, truthfully, sometimes if I will use, and I don't think this is hocus pocus, but I will use a seaweed fertilizer that has a lot of different things that are helping out roots, because if you can get that root mass super healthy and super energized, it will help the entire plant as well.
Makes good sense. We have another question from the audience now. Hi,
I'm Rose. We live down by near Cable, Wisconsin, in the woods, and we're heavily wooded with maple and oak, and we get these little maples that don't grow any bigger than maybe 6 inches. And it, on about a quarter of an acre throughout our property. And I thought I heard once that you could mow them and that would keep them back, or is there really any problem with all of those maple, as I heard the lady saying that the maple sucked up all the water, so.
I mean, you're asking you want to get rid of them?
I don't know if they're good, bad, indifferent. They're interesting that they only grow about 6 inches. And I think somebody said you can kind of mow them down. I have some spring ephemerals that like to come up, and sometimes if the maple comes up first, I can't see the ephemerals.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and maples will sit at a very low height until they get the opportunity to grow bigger. So they're an understory tree, so as long as there's something above them, they'll just kind of maintain themselves. And then if the tree above them disappears, then they'll shoot up and grow. So it's really a question of what you want to do. But if you want to encourage other wildflowers, then, you know, it's if you can get in there and cut them when the wildflowers aren't there, or, you know, possibly work on them in the fall a little bit. But it's part of the nature of the tree.
This is a little more labor-intensive answer, but what I do in that case is wait for a very hard, long rain so that the soil is nice and wet, and then just go pull by hand, and they come up very quickly. I mean, but if you leave them, they're fine for the forest floor. But yeah, you probably will get fewer spring ephemerals if they're all there.
I pull mine after a big rain, or I have also been known to get the hose out.
Yes. Make it easy.
And make it a little easier, for sure. We'll take another question from the audience, and then we've got some callers online with questions.
Hi, George Mashin. Just a follow-up question on the maples. I mean, I'd love to have those maples. Are those little ones easily transplantable, and how would you go about that?
Yeah, what I would do is, ideally, if you're going to transplant them, dig them up when they're small, put them in liner pots for a year or two, and then put them where you'd like. You know, one of the challenges if you plant a really small tree out in the yard, it's going to have a hard time with lawnmowers and everything else. So you got it. But yeah, I would just take a lot of those and pot them up for a year or two and then transplant them. Because what you find is once you pot them up, they grow fast. And then you can get a better tree to work with.
Let's take a call from Danelle in Madison. Danelle, hi.
Hi.
What's on your mind?
My question is a follow-up on the nitrogen being sucked out of the soil with wood. I put in a new perennial bed last year and didn't know if it did a nice like, mulch job around the plant with wood chips. And I do have plants here, but I'm wondering if I should perhaps be supplementing some nitrogen to those
I didn't quite hear the question. I think she might have said something about mulch, wood mulch on top of the soil. As long as it's on top, it's great. That's fine. You just don't want pieces of wood or sawdust that has not been decomposed mixed in with your soil where the roots want to be, because that wood will fix the nitrogen away. Or suck it up, basically.
And even if you add some...
It might just keep taking.
It might go a little faster, might break down a little faster.
That's true, yeah.
So, there's that. Thanks, Danelle, appreciate it. Jerome in Platteville, your turn. Hi, Jerome.
Hello, I hope you can hear me all right. I just have a question. About, I have a potted jade, and there's a little mushroom body that had fruited in my pot, and I had wondered if this is a possible problem, or if it's okay if it's just a small portion.
It's perfectly fine. You can remove it, it'll be fine. It likely came in on whatever your potting soil is. Might even help out the soil ecology within that pot. You should be good to go. I this has happened to me many, many times, and it really never hurts the plant.
All right, there you go, Jerome. And let's go to Jane in Waupun. Hi, Jane.
Hello.
Hi, what's on your mind?
I'm wondering if you recommend the product Preen for outdoor flower gardens.
Yeah, Preen is what we call a pre-emergent herbicide. Trifluralin is the active ingredient. And a couple things, it's an excellent question because that comes up a lot as far as using herbicides in general. The number one thing you have to look at on the label is make sure whatever plants are in the bed or the soil you're going to apply that herbicide to are on that label to make sure it's labeled. There are some vegetables, there are annuals, there are perennials on there. But also take a look at other options. Herbicides are one tool. A pre-emergent will basically what it does is it kills germinating seeds in the soil. It does not kill existing perennial weeds. But again, make sure everything's on the label as far as plants you want to keep. But also look at things like mulching, other alternatives to weed control. But in the right place, it can be a good tool. In particular, if you have a larger area where mulching maybe is not an option and you want to keep at least some of the annual weeds down, it's something you certainly can look at. And it'll last, if you put it down now, it'll last the first part of the season, give you protection against most of the annual weeds.
There you go. Thanks so much for that question. Well, I tell you what, we're having a lot of fun here today at the Bayfield Pavilion. A couple of great guests for us today, Bruce Bagenberg and Erica Hanekel, who have been answering questions right along and doing a wonderful job with it. If you have a question, you can join in again. The number's 800-642-1234. Email to talk@wpr.org. And our audience has been doing a great job right here in front of us asking questions. And we can encourage you to continue to do that as well. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk on WPR News. Great to have you along for this edition of Garden Talk as we broadcast from the Bayfield Pavilion in Bayfield to celebrate Bayfield in Bloom. with a great audience here and a couple of wonderful guests as well. Bruce Bagenberg, UW Extension Horticulture Educator for Iron County, Erica Hanekel, formerly Professor of Environmental History at Northland College, Master Gardener, and author of a couple of books. So wonderful to have them with us. Questions, give us a call at 800-642-1234, email to talk at WPR.org. And we have another question from the audience. Wonderful. Thank you for your question.
My name is Lori Fox. I'm from Butternut. And I have a question about one of my perennial beds has been inundated by ants. It's surrounded by rocks. They come in through the succulents, and then they've taken over this garden. I feel like digging up the whole garden and starting over. So, ideas?
Yeah.
What do you? Well, you both might have something for us on that one. Erica, you want to start?
Yeah, my go-to for that, and this has happened a few times to me with raised beds, is the little ant stakes that you put in the soil, and you can just put, you know, a couple around the bed, and the ants come in and they take the poison that is in there and they take it back to their nest, and it goes throughout the nest. So it's very, very localized. It does not spread at all. It just goes straight into the ant nest.
Okay. Bruce?
Yeah, I was going to say the same thing. And the other option would be, since there are so many different kinds of ants out there, we do have an entomology diagnostic lab, insect diagnostic lab with UW Extension also, so you can work with us on that. Just to plug another thing we have Ask a Gardener online, especially for those of you in counties where we don't have horticulture or agriculture staff available. You can submit questions, you can submit pictures. So that's another option. Be if it's some unusual species of ants, maybe there's a very specific way to get rid of it.
Yeah, there we go. Let's go to Mary in Chippewa Falls next. Hi, Mary.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. Sure. So about 6 years ago, I was doing a healthy lake garden, and we got compost. But what got introduced were jumping worms, and we have seen what they're doing now is our actual lawn is all the grass because they feed and take the root system, and we don't know how to control it because we're just losing, our lawn.
Yeah. Oh, how devastating. I'm so sorry. At least I would suggest smothering. And what I have come to understand is that if you can get a thick plastic but see-through sheets of plastic and then staple it down, right, or use rocks to cover it, try not to let any air out, right? And so that soil will become solarized and it will kill everything like within several inches of the top of it. That's the sort of most organic way. I think that would also, if you could sort of go beyond, a little bit beyond the borders of where they are right now to try and catch any that might have escaped even further, I guess that would be my number one suggestion. How about you, Bruce?
Yeah, it's another one of our new, relatively new problems, and there's no easy answer to it. That's one option. Sometimes we're limited with the solarization, we don't get enough sun, enough warm weather to do it, but it might work. I know there are some chemical options. Again, you could go look at the specific scenario. Our horticulture website does have some information on jumping worms that might help as well. But the problem with them is they're just so aggressive in terms of decomposition compared to the native earthworms.
Yeah, the important thing is to try and keep them out to begin with. Yeah. Being careful about plants that you select, and that is really the number one thing. As you were talking, I was thinking back to my youth. I grew up in a area of southern Wisconsin where tobacco was raised for chewing tobacco and all that, and I made a lot of money cutting tobacco stalks and harvesting it, but the you know, when I was 14, 15 years old. But there were tobacco beds where they raised the tobacco plants to begin with, and before they would raise the bed, there was a couple of guys that had steamers, and they would come and steam the beds. Literally, the beds were covered, and this, I don't remember how the contraption worked, but actually the steam was in every inch of that bed. And I don't think I ever saw a tobacco bed that had a weed in it. it was really quite, and I often thought, gee, it'd be nice if we could do that on a different kind of a scale, just steaming that bed, and it didn't take that long.
Somebody needs to take that up as a business proposition.
Well, it was a long time ago, but I'm telling you, it worked. Probably still does somewhere. I'm long gone from that, but just a little side work. Let's take a question from the audience.
Hi, this is Mitch. I'm from Sun Prairie. I have dwarf lilacs, and I'm trying to figure out when is the best time to kind of trim them back and keep them under control, because I did it last year, probably at the wrong time, and didn't flower much. So when's the best time to attack them, keep them under control, to get them to flower?
Within 2 weeks when they're done blooming. So get ready.
Yep.
But that's a good point. If you wait too long, or some people, if you prune them first thing in the spring, the problem is the flower bud was formed the previous year. So if you get after them the first 2 weeks after they're done blooming, you're ahead of the game, and then the flower buds will form on the new growth, and you'll have flowers next year.
Just as an aside, for those of us, many in southern Wisconsin have already lost their lilacs, or they're well past bloom, but here in Bayfield, there are just some
peak
gorgeous
flowering,
flowering lilacs. We had a bouquet on the breakfast table this morning, and it was the brightest, best looking I could ever remember seeing. It was just beautiful.
They smell amazing.
They do indeed. Jill's raising her hand at me. We have another question from the audience.
Hi, I'm Judy Reese from Bayfield. All of a sudden, we have these little, tiny, tiny little worm-like things all over the side of our house. Is this our new pest this year? What is it?
Are they furry?
Are they furry and black?
No, they're really tiny, not like the furry type.
Hard to say. I mean, spongy moth comes, what used to be called gypsy moth comes to mind, but if you're saying, if they would be black and they would have fine hairs on their body and they're gonna grow really fast, it could be something coming out of the soil. There's a good example, if you can get some pictures of it, put it up on our Ask a Gardener and one of us will look at it.
Yeah, we might have an answer within the audience. Yeah.
Our next guest, but he'll be able to, anyway.
Oh, yeah.
That's definitely the spongy moth in Bayfield right now. It's all over, and they're blowing. They're really small right now, so they're blowing in the wind and showing up all over the edges of everything. This is much heavier than last year, and last year was already a bad one.
Last year was terrible.
Was that Paul?
That's Paul.
Paul Segan, will be our guest in about 8 minutes.
There you go.
Well, hold on to your spongy moth question. Actually, I should just mention we'll be zeroing in at noon on landscape trees, fruit trees, vines. So our guests know all about that. So we'll be doing that at afternoon, after 12 o'clock, I should say. Now, go ahead. Jill has another person in the audience.
Hi, I'm Tom Mitchell. Will you speak to the health of the honeybees and the bumblebees, please?
Yeah, that's an excellent point. I mean, obviously, a lot of interest and a lot of movements in the last few years have been, pollinators in general, the Nomo May, and using pollinator plants, we've talked a little bit about, but also avoiding, especially some of the broad spectrum insecticides. In any blooming plant that you're treating for an insect pest, be, very aware of pollinators, especially honeybees and bumblebees. Some of the issues have been, mites in the hives over the winter. Those of you that are beekeepers, which I'm not, but I'm certainly well aware of those problems that with the bees, they've had a hard time overwintering because of that. But a combination of things. But you know, as a gardener, the two things you can do is plant more pollinating plants, more blooming plants, more perennial plants, and then be very careful with insecticide use. You know, look at if you have an alternative insecticide, which that's one of the things that's changed a lot. You know, I mentioned I spent most of my career in Illinois, going back quite a ways. You know, if you look at the last 30 years, insecticides available in garden centers have drastically changed from a lot of broad spectrum materials to now some that are very specific, very short-lived.
Yeah.
It's good news, bad news. It's very good news for the environment, excellent news for pollinators, but it also requires more education on the user to know what's that insecticide, what it can and can't do for you. But I don't know if that answers your question.
You would still, I mean, I would just suggest it to everyone as an environmental historian, please try to avoid neonics as much as you possibly can. Neonicotinoids are just not good for pollinators. One specific plant that I love, this is my go-to for filling shady areas that the pollinators love, all of them, I think, that also gives height and color to a shady area is Simisifugia racemosa, or it's called bugbane or black cohosh. It does really, really well in near full shade, bright reflected light. Probably can't take full sun all day long, but it will get up to, in some areas of my garden, when it's blooming with these huge, gorgeous, honey-scented that just, it fills the garden with huge white panicles of gigantic, gorgeous flowers. And you can get them in like very dark, almost black, feathery foliage, all the way up to green and light green. So it goes all year. Like this plant never looks bad. It comes up, it comes back every year, it comes back bigger. It can get to 7 feet in my garden, although more, you know, in other spots it might max out at about 3 feet. But I love black cohosh.
And now there are a lot of people who are listening or saying, well, wait a minute, I love the idea of that plant. What was that plant name again?
Yes.
So let's repeat that.
Yeah. Simisifuga ramosa. The common name would be bugbane or black cohosh. It really just became kind of popular on the market, I would say maybe 5 years ago. And it's still, I think, fairly hard to get up here, but if you go to garden centers, larger garden centers, I'm able to find as many as I like, and that's another one that divides politely. Like let it grow for at least 3 years in your garden, maybe even four, and then it will start sort of forming like bigger clumps, and then you just take that sharp spade, take a clump of it, plant it somewhere else. It gives just beautiful form, and I love the deep purple, the deep blacks, right? Kind of back to the doll's eyes creepiness. But just for contrast too, because you want contrast in a shady garden, because in a shady garden you don't have flowers all the time. So the deep purples with the lighter greens kind of give you that sense of interest in a perennial shady garden.
Where did this hour go?
I don't know.
It has flown by for me, and I bet it has for everybody else here. I want to thank you both so much for taking time to be with us today. Bruce Spangenberg is UW Extension Horticulture Educator for Iron County. Erica Hanekel, former professor of environmental history at Northland College, master gardener, and her book, which I'm going to have to interview her about this book, is titled Orchid Muse, A History of Obsession in 15 Flowers. We'll get her on for that. And coming up, we've got a whole lot more, a whole nother hour of garden talk in just a minute. I'm Larry Mealer. You're listening to Garden Talk. Larry Mueller here. That applause coming from our audience at the Bayfield Pavilion. And we're switching topics a little bit. I mean, we're still talking about gardening, but we're talking about the trees and the shrubs and the vines in particular, because we have a couple of guests who know a whole lot about that. Paul Segan's been with us before. Paul is the DNR Forest Health Specialist from Hayward. Paul, great to have you back.
Thanks, Larry. It's good to be here.
And I think for the first time, Phil Brosh is co-owner of Bayfield Winery and Blue Ox Cider, and does a lot of cool things with vines and fruit trees.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Really great to have both of you with us. And I hope you'll join in. Questions, comments you have about trees or orchards or grapes, you can be part of the conversation on WPR News. The number to call, 800-642-1234. Email to talk at WPR.org. Phil, let's start with you. Tell us a little about your business.
All right. Well, we are just located in the Bayfield Fruit Loop region on Betzel Road outside of town. And we grow about 30 acres of apples. We have around 8 acres of grapes, some pears on the property. And lately, we've been doing a lot of grafting to switch some of our older dessert varieties of apples into more cider-specific and perry-specific apples and pears for our hard cider products and then our wines as well.
So did you bring any along for me to sample? Or
I can get some down here pretty quick for you.
I'll probably be sampling them at some point over the course of this day or the next. Thank you so much for being with us. And Paul, as I said, welcome back. Last year was a stressful one for trees.
It was a big year of drought. We talked about that in the last hour. And fortunately, we are largely reversing that trend right now. So in spite of the gloom outside, this is good news for trees. And we're hoping that this is really going to help them start to recover from the several years of drought and the insect cycles that we've seen come with it.
Yeah, just a year is, 1 year of drought, that's one thing. But when you get 4, 5, whatever, however many in a row, even the mature trees, I worry a lot about those.
Yeah, in some cases, the older the tree is, the more time it's going to take to recover. And when you add defoliation from things like spongy moth, oak leaf roller, jack pine budworm, spruce budworm, a whole lot of different defoliators we can talk about, that's going to set the tree back even further. And what we often say is 2 to 3 years of recovery is required after these extended droughts, especially when they're stacked with other stressors. So always a good idea to keep in mind that trees are alive and they need time to recover too before things like harvesting and thinnings and other disturbance around trees.
Yeah, so if you get 4, 3, 4, 5 years of problems, it's going to, as you say, it's going to take, not going to do it overnight. It's going to take another 3 years or 4 years maybe to get them back into shape.
Exactly.
Phil, I want to talk about grapes because we always get a lot of questions about grapes, not only on Garden Talk, but if I have an entomologist on or something, the grapes come up a lot. What tips do you have for listeners who want to grow grapes?
I would really look at your area and the variety or the varietal of which grape you should plant in that. We use a lot of cold hardy hybrid wine grapes on our property. Most of them were developed through the University of Minnesota, and so they're crossing some of the more well-known varieties with grapes that were already native to the U.S. So they have that cold hardiness resistance. They also have a lot of disease resistance. Some of our favorites that we grow, we haven't sprayed anything on them since 2018, and they work really well in this region, which a lot of people are surprised because we're about as far north as you can go in the state.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of options now. We also have a little experimental plot that the UW Extension is running on our property where they have some seedless table grapes that the University of Minnesota is developing. So we're getting to watch. Jason Fishbach, our local extension agent, is in charge of that project here, and they put them in a couple years ago. So it's fun to see some of the more eating style grapes where ours are more for pressing and making into wine.
Yeah, that is great. Christy in Chippewa County has a question that kind of relates to, I think, this. Let's go there. Hi, Christy. Thanks for calling.
Hi, thank you. Looking for recommendations, the red oak here are coming to oak wilt, but looking to replace hopefully with an oak because of, you know, the dead palamy, indexing the number of species that depend on oaks. I've heard white oak might be the one to consider going forward with heating climate. Do you have other species as well to recommend? Thank you.
Yeah, well, we got bur oaks.
Yeah, that's always a great question. Oaks are a very good species. We do have problems with oak wilt, particularly with red oak. That's why often white oak, swamp white oak, bur oak are good replacement measures where oak wilt is a problem, and they are more resistant to oak wilt. Also, there's a whole list of different things that can be planted, things like birch, things like sycamore, Kentucky coffee tree. I'd recommend going online. UW Extension has a fantastic list of what's called ash tree replacement species. But in there, you can find a whole lot of different varieties. But absolutely, the swamp white oak might be a good selection in a site like that.
Oh, man, I'm telling you, there's a swamp white oak on the UW-Madison campus that I love to go by. It is an older, just absolutely beautiful, beautiful tree.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So there you go, Charlotte. Thanks a lot for calling. You can join in too, 800-642-1234, email to talk at WPR.org. And we have a question from our audience.
My name is Pam Betcher from Gordon, and I have two unrelated questions. The first has to do with our organic tree, fruit tree orchard that's in good farm soil. Borderline zone 4. We'd like to introduce apricot trees and have done some research on the varieties that do well in that zone. Just wondering if you have any recommendations and a resource. And then the second unrelated question is probably more for Paul, which has to do, because I have had oak wilt on my property, when the best time to prune safely. Thank you.
All right, with the apricot question, we don't grow those on the property, so I don't have a ton of experience with that. But what I would say is look at the University of Minnesota's website, see what options they have. They've really done a lot with doing some hybridizing with those so that they are working in colder regions. There are a lot that I've been hearing that are working in the area. We've had some on the property, but we get a little bit more extreme sometimes in the winter, and I've seen some that have the tag on them, but there's nothing growing anymore. So they were there a while ago, and I don't know what year they were planted. We took the farm over in 2021. But.
As to the oak wilt question, oak wilt is a highly lethal fungal disease, primarily of red oaks, and it's become more common in northwest Wisconsin, northern Wisconsin. But one of the easiest ways to prevent it is to time your pruning right. And that is in northern Wisconsin and in southern Wisconsin, really, to avoid pruning oaks, any pruning, wounding, or cutting of oaks during the periods of April through July every year. And that's because small picnic beetles can carry the disease spores to these cut sites, a wounded tree, a stump, and infect that tree. And then it can spread below ground to neighboring oaks. And so if you want to be really safe, wait to the end of October to do any pruning. If you have to prune because a storm damaged a limb and it has to be cut off during that period, April through July, very crucial to be using pruning sealant, thing like a latex-based paint or a pruning sealer on that cut immediately after the cut is made. That can save the tree from a lethal dose of oak wilt.
Yeah. Let's take a question from Don in Iron River. Hi, Don.
Hello. Say, I've been having problems finding ice wine around here. Do you grow ice wine or make ice wine or any clues where I could find some?
I've got a bottle in my refrigerator at home. go ahead, Bill.
We do have some experimental bottles that we've done from a couple of years ago, but right now our production is so little that we haven't had it, because it's almost 20 times the amount of grapes to make the same amount of volume because it comes so concentrated. So we did hold one year. We held a row and we picked them December 20th. There was 2 feet of snow, so that was interesting picking grapes then. But I know there are a lot of growers in Wisconsin that are making that. I'm trying to remember if Wollersheim is one of them. I would have to look at a list and see offhand, but the Wisconsin Winery Association would probably, their website may be a good resource for that.
I think that bottle that I have in my refrigerator is from Wollersheim. So There are many. There are quite a few actually here in the state that do it. Jill has another person with a question.
Hi, I'm Barb Dorsweiler. We have property about an hour west of here in sand country with lots of jack pine, and they're looking pretty emaciated from last year's infestation, and I didn't know there was a jack pine bug. But my question is, what are the odds they're going to recover? I didn't know if pine trees could recover from that kind of damage.
Yeah, that's a good question. I'm guessing it was the jack pine budworm that defoliated the trees last year, and we had the largest outbreak of that budworm in the last about 15 years. Last year, we mapped about 80,000 acres, primarily in the northwest sands around where you are, about an hour west of here. So it was devastating to a lot of jack pine. We saw defoliation over 50% of the needles consumed last year. Some early surveys this year are showing that the population, unfortunately, is carrying over from last year, and it will probably be high. A couple of years of heavy defoliation where we're getting more than, you know, 30 to 50% defoliation of the needles is really going to stress the trees out. Whether the tree will die or not is going to depend on how droughty the soils are. Generally, jack pine grow on sandy soils, but there is a spectrum there too where you can have really nutrient poor sands versus somewhat more nutrient rich. Those poor sands are not going to support jack pine after 2 years of heavy defoliation. So I'd watch the trees closely, and if they do appear to start to get top kill, the upper spire few feet of death in that, would be time to think about removing those trees before they might help the bark beetle population build up, which could then infest some of your other trees.
Yeah, very, very good point. I want to go to Dan in Lone Rock because he has something about an earlier question relating to apricots. So let's go there. Dan?
Yeah, I just wanted to recommend a resource is Purvis Nursery and an Orchard in Idaho, P-U-R-V-I-S. Robert's got some quite a range of pretty hardy apricots that he grows and sells. He used to live in Minnesota. Among those are the Harrow series, so like Hard Rand, Hard Glow, and then he's got some interesting stuff like from the more mountainous regions of Afghanistan and Uzbekistan and that kind of stuff. That's really kind of cool, pushing the edges of the cold hardiness.
And just give me the name once more of the company.
Purvis Nursery, P-U-R-V-I-S. They've got a website there in Idaho.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call very much. So maybe a source. I was thinking about it. I was in Pakistan once, and I did have some apricots in Pakistan. That was a long time ago, but I remember them because they were juicy. Mary in Eau Claire, we'll go to you. Hi, Mary.
Hi. Hello.
Hi, what's on your mind?
I'm sorry, I don't remember the name of the tree, but it was developed, I believe, in somewhere near Bayfield, and it grows only to about 8 feet and stops. It's doesn't bother any indigenous things. It has roots that go down and clean the water or the seepage from around places like in garbage dumps or whatever, and it's lovely. It grows quickly, and it is but only to about 8 feet tall. And people, I've been telling people about this wonderful tree for it must be a year. And everybody wants one, and I can't remember what the name of it is or where to send them to find it. But
I have a problem like that from time to time. Mary. So I feel your pain. Paula?
Yeah, that's really interesting. The concept she's alluding to is called bioremediation. It's where those roots and that tree, its function, can take up some of the toxins in the soil. And I have heard that up at, I think it was the University of Duluth, they were breeding an aspen variety, Populus, that had those characteristics. But I know willow has been used, Salix as the genus, has been used for bioremediation. But I don't know specifically which variety she's talking about, whether it willow or popple there.
But one of those likely. Mary, thank you so much. If you ever remember, shoot me an email and let me know. you can join in too, 800-642-1234. We've got a couple of guests for you today. Paul Segan, DNR Forest Health Specialist, works out of Hayward. Phil Brash is co-owner of Bayfield Winery and Blue Ox Cider. Our guest for Garden Talk on Wisconsin Public Radio News. I'm Larry Mueller. Great to have you along for this edition of Garden Talk as we broadcast from Bayfield, the Bayfield Pavilion, to kind of celebrate Bayfield in bloom. It's a great experience for me to share, and it would be for you as well. That there are a lot of events coming. I just wanted to mention an event or two. On Sunday, something I haven't participated in or watched, but I think it'd be a very cool thing. There's the Blessing of the Fleet, which starts at 1 o'clock at Memorial Park, and if you got a boat, all boats are welcome to participate. It's kind of an ecumenical service and blessing ceremony. So the boats are blessed on Sunday. And then if you want to see some really good gardens, June 8th, so that's a week away or so, there's a self-guided tour of Bayfield's gardens. And that I have participated in, and I can tell you, it's a wonderful experience. See, there are some dandy gardens here. And you can find out more. There's a whole bunch of things going on. Go to bayfield.org, and you're going to find what else is going on in the community. And not only Bayfield, but neighboring communities like Washburn, where there's a really thriving community going. I love that place. Doing a little work downtown, and so the streets are, a couple of streets are a little off, but you can get through to those businesses, and I encourage you to take a walk through there and take a look, because you're really going to enjoy it as well. So we're talking about trees and orchards and vines with our two guests today, Paul Segan, Phil Brash. I hope you'll join in. And we have a question from the audience, I believe, so let's go there.
Hey, my name is Sue. I live here in Bayfield. And that tree, the wonderful tree that is going to save the world, it's a popple tree. It was for sale at Hauser's. I don't think they have any right now, but it's in collaboration with the university project. They'll definitely make more. And the other thing I was going to ask, is the Forest Service planning to spray for the spongy moth in Bayfield?
Good question. Spongy moth is very active in Bayfield County. I'll just give a little summary of what happened last year. We had our largest outbreak in state history last year, where we mapped over 375,000 acres. That was a state record. The majority of that defoliation occurred up here in northern Bayfield County and parts of northern Ashland County. We had defoliation down in south central Wisconsin and north southeast Wisconsin too, and we are expecting quite a bit of defoliation again this year, which will mark the third year in a row of this outbreak. The good news is early signs are indicating that the diseases, both viral and bacterial, are starting to take hold, and these populations are likely to start to phase off this year. There might be some spillover into 2025, but hopefully the lion's share will come and go by the end of this year. In terms of spraying, there is no planned spraying up in this area by the Forest Service or the state DNR. The state DNR does not have any spray programs for that are cost share or state sponsored for private landowners, but private landowners can organize a spray with their fellow neighbors or if they have a large enough block and have that area sprayed. It's too late this year to do that. Spraying can be very effective, and so we've done it on some DNR property in the southeast part of the state on some of the state park properties, and those are largely done. Those are done now, and meanwhile, the DATCAP does what's called the Slow the Spread spray program, which focuses on new areas where the pest is not yet established in western Wisconsin. And those sprays are using bacterial insecticide, BTK, and those are happening right now down in Chippewa, Russ County. In the last couple of days, there's been spraying there. But really, for individual yard trees, there's a whole slew of different control measures that you can take that are fairly straightforward and practical, but they do take a little bit of sweat equity to employ. But there's plenty of information online. I can answer any specific questions on those as we go along here. But as far as spraying goes, yeah. We're not focused on this area, but we have plenty of information on other controls.
Thanks very much for that question. Let's go to Sandy and Stevens Point. Hi, Sandy.
Thank you. Hi, Larry and guests. Quick question for you. I have a Cleveland pear growing, and I noticed the other day that some of the suckers that are coming up are bleaching, and the leaves of them, and it's also occurring like in the lawn, my lawn and the neighbor's lawn, and they had cleaned out their hot tub, and I'm wondering if you think this might be either fungal related or chemical related, and if you know depending on your answer, what you think I could do to help relieve some of the stress on the Cleveland pear.
Is it just on the suckers, or is it on the tree itself that you're seeing the coloration change?
Right now, it's just on the suckers.
I've never run into something like that, but I would imagine removing some of those, watching the tree closely to see if there's any changes on that. I tend to go lighter on, or taking some time to monitor things before doing big changes. With this situation, I would just watch it closely, remove the suckers on the ground. They're going to be sapping energy from the tree anyways. And then just seeing if that starts to change within the tree. If it's a fungal thing, you could do some different sprays. I know copper, Captan, things like that. We use also some different horticulture oils, and sometimes we'll even spray, it's been a couple years now, but we've used sheep's cheese whey, and it was to create a living bacteria on the leaves so that it has a harder time getting colonies that you don't want on the tree started.
That's really cool. Hadn't heard of that practice. That's pretty interesting. Let's see, Jill has got another question. Questioner.
Yeah, hi, I'm Brian from Duluth. Two apple tree questions. One is, I have three trees, and how do I even out the blooms? Last year, a million apples. This year, very few blooms at all. Is there a way to kind of even that out for yearly? And then the second question is, these three trees are kind of in the woods. I've got a lot of sooty blotch. Is there anything I can do to minimize that?
So the first question, with that, you can hand thin, especially with three trees. So there's going to be one strong fruit set within each blossom called the king. And you can pinch off the other ones. That'll help reserve some of the energy for the next year. We don't do that because we have too many, and you can chemically thin too, but it's a lot of, we just kind of have a biennial orchard. Some years are heavier, some years are lighter, and it kind of works itself out over the years. With three trees, it wouldn't be too hard to go through and hand thin. The sooty blot, you'll probably need some sort of spray for that if it's getting too bad. I'm not sure what you're using. Are these eating apples?
Eating apples. Yeah.
Yeah, then I would, if it's getting too much where you're not able to eat them and enjoy them, I would look into some fungal sprays for that. Again, we try not to do a whole lot, and ours, we press everything to make hard cider, so I'm usually pretty light on the sprays, and sometimes it bites us. We've had rougher years where I probably should have. But yeah, you could look at that if it's beginning to grow each year and getting worse.
Thanks for that question. Linda in Wausau has a question, I believe, relating to forest management.
Hi, I purchase land that's in forest management, and I'm wondering if the DNR is looking at modifying their requirements for required removal of trees based on the role trees play in eliminating greenhouse gases and also the role climate change is playing in our state.
Yeah, that's an interesting question. You know, I don't know the specific answer to that. If there's any kind of modifications to what you're probably talking about is the Managed Forest Law, which is a tax program that landowners like yourself can enroll in to get a tax incentive to manage the land and forestry in a sustainable manner. But that would be a great question for one of your local DNR forestry tax law specialists. And you could probably look them up online on the DNR website to find out who's servicing that area in Wausau. I'm guessing they're out of the Wausau office, but that's a good point, and it relates to carbon credits and retention of trees for offsetting carbon greenhouse gas. I know some of the forestry county forestry programs are diving into those programs. DNR, I don't think has adopted that yet in the MFL program, but that is a great question to put to the local specialist in your area.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for that question. And Jill has another call from our question from the audience.
Hi, I'm Jerry. I'm from Iron River, Wisconsin, sand country. I admired a neighbor's grapevines. And a couple of years ago, he gave me cuttings, six plants. I kept four of them alive, planted them a couple of years ago. They're taken off on the trellis. They look great, and they're coming back this year again. I even got a couple of grapes last year. But is there something I should fertilize that with? And if so, what time and with what?
I would start with a soil test on that to see before you do any additions, or if you are able to, if you have a compost pile that you're doing at home, put in a little bit on that each year. But a soil test will give you an answer of where you're at. Do you think, is it extremely sandy there?
Yes, but before I planted them, I did dig it out about a foot deep and did put some good soil in there, so.
Most of their roots are gonna go much deeper than that,
yeah,
too, so that could be part of it. A lot of ours are 3 feet down where they're really getting deep. But I would do a soil test to start. I know you can send them to the UW or the extension agent in the area, and they can do it pretty cheaply.
Yeah, UW Soil and Plant Analysis Laboratory. And you tell them what you have and what you intend to do with the soil, and then they'll tell you, okay, well, based on grapes and grapevines, here's where you are.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so that's pretty cool, actually. Dan in Brule, we'll go to you. Hi, Dan.
Hello, how are you today? Thanks for taking my call. I'm talking about plants on the forest floor, which are in bloom right now, is the Trillium serenum, I guess the nodding trilliums. And one, are they transferable? Is that even legal to do that? And number two, if they aren't, are there places where we can get them to, purchase and put in a nice little edge along the garden there?
Yeah, problem with that is they're growing in that forest.
Yes.
And they like it there.
Yeah, that forest floor has some characteristics that really help them thrive there. Whenever you're going to transplant, obviously you want permission from the property owner. I don't think you can do that on DNR property. County forests seems unlikely too, but possibly if there's a private landowner who's got an abundance, they wouldn't mind. But I would think the soil conditions to where you're going to plant them has to be fairly rich to accommodate a successful transplant. And so probably quite a bit of nitrogen, quite a bit of good humus in that media you're going to plant into.
Yeah, and quite a bit of shade.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You put them in direct sun,
they might burn up.
Yeah, they might burn up for sure. So something to think about, Dan. Thank you very much for calling, and I'm looking around here, and I'm seeing Alyssa in Sparta with a question. Hi, Alyssa.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. My partner and I moved into our property about 7 years ago, and our lilac bushes are struggling, and I actually shouldn't call it a bush. It's more like a tree. And they're probably almost two stories tall, but they're not blooming as well. We did try to thin them out this early spring, which seemed to help some, but just wondering if there's any suggestions or if they kind of have maybe outlived their life expectancy.
Yeah, those tall ones, you want to whack those down, right, Paul? I mean, you want to take a third of those out.
Yeah,
every year.
You do want to do some pruning on the lilac. Now, is this a tree lilac or is this a bush lilac?
I don't think it's a bush. I think it's a tree, but
Yeah, so it sounds like it could be Japanese tree lilac, which is related, yeah. Syringia. But I think probably make sure it was planted properly, and if it's not, that could be a problem with stem girdling roots. Making sure there's plenty of good mulch around that tree, around at least the width of the drip line, the canopy of that tree, and then also making sure it's well watered, and then doing some pruning every year on that tree to make sure it continues to grow vigorously would be some good recommendations.
You do get a root flare on those too, don't you?
Yes, you do. Just like a normal tree, you'd have that flare root that flares out right at the base where it meets the ground, and that should be visible. Anytime you plant a tree, generally you want to be able to see that flare. Otherwise, it's planted too deep, which can lead to stem girdling roots and other infestation from soil-going insects, beetles and such.
Very good question. Thank you so much, Alyssa. Linda in Appleton will go to you. Hi, Linda.
Hi, guys. Hey, great show. I have an infestation of buckthorn in my lawn, and it's recently reseeded, you know, to make it thicker. And I just keep mowing it off, but it seems to be spreading every year. Any idea what I can use on it, but I don't want to kill the grass.
Yeah, good question. Buckthorn is one of those really pesky invasive shrubs we have all throughout Wisconsin, and unfortunately becoming more common in northern Wisconsin. We want to keep it at bay with not just mechanical control like you've been doing by mowing it, but we also need to pair that with herbicide application. And so this is one of those plants that need the herbicide, otherwise they continue to grow back and can actually become sometimes more vigorous. We just sort of tick it off if we only mow it or only cut it. And so one of the common things to use is triclopyr on that. Common names are like Element 4 or Garlon 4. That's a heavy-duty brush herbicide that can be applied generally in the fall, when it's the best time for uptake. You know, you can cut off or mow that plant and then spray the herbicide onto that cut area, whether it's a stem, whether a cut stump stem, or whether it's the cut stump sprigs that are left behind. But it's really important to do that, and fall is about the best time to apply it.
And you want to, I don't know that I'd want to just generally spray around. I think you'd want to be spot spraying on that, or because it's in lawn.
Yeah, it's going to be targeted. You're going to want to use the proper applicator and make sure it gets on the right surface and very specific.
And it works best if it's a cut surface.
Yes.
For sure. Linda, good luck with that. Appreciate it. Brian emailed us. They have 3 2-year-old apple trees that budded but never bloomed this spring. Now they appear to be drying and dying. Other trees in the orchard are fine. Wondering what could cause this. 3 2-year-old apple trees budded but never bloomed, and now they're on their way out.
It could be the drought in the area, make sure they're watered, but also 2-year-old trees, you don't always want to expect fruit on them right away. The first years should really be focused on getting the root system strong, the structure of the tree. We pinch off blossoms for the first few years on ours, which is always hard to do because you want to see the apples. But it's way better for them in the long run. They really need to get that root structure down before they're really fruiting.
Thanks for that question. And I want to go back to you for a minute, Phil, because you used some non-traditional methods that I thought were kind of, you got sheep and poultry and in your orchards.
Yeah, Turner Road Farms, just outside of Bayfield, we've partnered with them, and they brought sheep over in our orchard last year and did our grazing and our fertilizing for us, and it was huge. I've never seen the color of green that comes in. It was almost instant. And Josh and Esme, who own the sheep, they would come by and they would move them about every 5 or 6 days into a new spot, so they were always happy. But it's huge. Where we have our older orchard used to, however, long time ago, used to be lake bed. And so it's got a lot of clay, and we like keeping the tractor out of there. And the sheep were so gentle on that, so we're not compacting that soil. The sheep were really happy too. We'd see them scratching against the trees and taking naps under the shade. So it was fun to see customers go out there and hang out with them and have a glass of wine and sit by some sheep for a little while. It's a good afternoon.
Sounds like a good afternoon to me, that's for sure. You have some other, you did mention one other non-traditional method earlier, but talk about some of the other things you may be
doing. Yeah, so then there were also chickens in the vineyard, and that was mostly to, it was kind of a try. We had 18, so it wasn't a lot, but it was in one of our smaller plots, and they would eat the bugs, scratch up the dirt. We could definitely tell, we would move that through the rows about every 5 days too, and you can see where they've been, even from the previous year. Everything is a little darker, a little more full in those areas. Another fun thing for customers too, they'd hop over the fence and go say hi to people while they're drinking wine.
Oh, I love it. Let's see, I had a listener in Bayfield, the community, we talked about the Emerald Ash Borer earlier, and we're gonna get to that. I wanna do a little pondering on that. Paul, as we talk about the Emerald Ash Borer, and I've got to remind everybody that here we are listening to Garden Talk, and I'm Larry Mueller, and you are listening to WPR News. You're listening to Garden Talk. Larry Mueller here as we broadcast from the Bayfield Pavilion to celebrate Bayfield in Bloom. Great to have you listening in, and great to have Paul Segan, our DNR forest specialist out of Hayward, and Phil Brash, who is the co-owner of the Bayfield Winery and Blue Ox Cider. So questions, you can give a call to 800-642-1234 or email to ideas@wpr.org. And we did have a listener from Bayfield talking about the outbreak of the Emerald Ash Borer.
Mm-hmm.
Wondering what happens to the infected trees after they are removed.
So we did basically remove the state quarantine for Emerald Ash Borer back in, I think, 2021. So there is no restriction on wood hauling of infested wood throughout the state. But we recommend folks who have a tree removed by an arborist or a tree service, ask the tree service to keep that wood local when they dispose it, not to bring it too much further than the township, and certainly keep it within the county. And that is going to help prevent the rate of spread into new areas. So we know that EAB is going to continue to spread in northern Wisconsin and all of the counties in Wisconsin. We actually hit almost a milestone this spring where we had the 71st detected county of EAB, and we have just one more left
one
to
more.
Go. But we do want to really.
What's the one that's left?
Yes, it's in my zone, so the pressure's all on me. it's Burnett County, so I'll be looking hard, and we very well might find it yet this year with eyes on it. But we know that this critter is going to continue to spread. But the good news for northern Wisconsin is that most of the ash are either asymptomatic or still alive and thriving, and so there's still a lot of opportunity for folks who own acreage to work with a professional forester to do a stand assessment and to consider doing some salvage of the ash before that forest doesn't have much value and it's too late. As far as individual shade tree, there's still a lot of time to treat them if you move quickly. Plenty of insecticides available to treat, both over-the-counter and professional-grade insecticides that have fantastic control against EAB. So although it's gloomy, there is a lot of opportunity for those who are proactive with this problem in northern Wisconsin.
Dan in Reedsburg has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Dan.
Hello, thank you for taking my call. I have a 75-foot pine tree that the top half of it, maybe more than the top half, died last year in the drought. And I really don't know if it was bugs as well as drought. I'm wondering if there's a chance for that tree to continue to grow now that it's wet, or should I have the whole tree taken down?
Boy, that's a good question.
75-footer.
75-footer. That's a lot of the tree to lose if you've lost half of it. And whether it's drought or beetles, I think it's probably a combination of both. Usually the way we see this work is drought stress leads to bark beetle infestation because the tree's defenses are highly compromised after drought. A tree like that is not likely going to recover very well. You know, if you let it sit, it could end up getting infested by more bark beetles and killed all outright, or it's going to have very malformed growth when that top is dead. So I would look at maybe a species you want to replace it with and consider having it removed safely.
Yeah, it's too bad. Sorry, Dan. I would hate to be losing a 75-footer myself. David in La Pointe, we'll give you a chance. Hi, David.
Thanks for my taking the call. I have two questions. First is mountain ash, and does the emerald ash borer affect those? I've been starting mountain ash from seed that I collect out in the forest, and then I put them in a pot, and sometimes it takes 2 years to sprout, sometimes 1 year. But I've got about 50 of them right now.
Ooh.
Yeah, the good news with that is that mountain ash is immune to EAB. It is not a true ash. So you are off the hook there. EAB is going to go after all our native ash trees, the green, white, and black, and the blue, small native down in the southeast, as well as white fringe tree, which is a little bit out of Wisconsin. But you are fine with mountain ash, so continue to grow those well. They're a beautiful tree.
And we have another comment from the audience.
Yeah, this is Gary again.
And my question is about buckthorn. I'm battling a big infestation of that on the property. I've been doing mechanical removal. I've been stripping limbs off it before they go to flower or before they go to berry. Mm-hmm. And I'm looking at some mechanical devices that pull these things out by the root up to a 3-inch shrub. So I'm wondering if anyone has any experience with these tools.
Yeah, I think you're referring to a weed wrench that kind of leverages the length of the pole and pulls it out from the root. That is a good measure to take. It's going to be more labor intensive for sure. And the other concern with that is that if you've got other buckthorn on the site, it could create a nice seed bed for any seeds that get spread by birds. So you're going to want to actually focus first on removing the seed bearing trees. This is a dioecious plant, meaning it's got two homes, a male and a female. And so you want to remove the females that are those seed bearing ones first to make sure it doesn't continue to reinfest. But yes, then using the weed wrench is a fantastic tool.
Thanks for that question. And we have another question from the audience.
I have two questions. Peter from Washburn. The first is last Christmas I bought some chestnuts, decided I did not like them, put them out for the squirrels, and this spring in my garden I'm finding chestnuts. and I'm thinking, well, these might be good trees to transplant. Will they thrive in the Washburn area?
Well, that's a good question. Do you know what the origin of the chestnut were? If it might be Chinese chestnut or American chestnut?
No, they were out of Walmart.
Okay, yeah. Yeah.
Walmart chestnuts.
Yeah. I don't know if I'd recommend those. But in any case, yeah, it's hard to say, but if they are the native American chestnut, it's unlikely they're going to thrive for too much longer because we do have chestnut blight in parts of West Salem in Wisconsin, which is a long ways away. But some of these remote populations that have been planted in Wisconsin actually did end up getting infected with the chestnut blight all the way from the northeast, which I don't know how that's possible, but it happened. So there is a risk that chestnut blight could infect and kill them. There are some resistant varieties of chestnut. I believe the Chinese chestnut has been bred with the American to create a resistant strain, but the origin of those, it's hard to say. It's kind of sketchy, and I don't know if they would do well.
The second question, I have seven apple trees in the forest. I assume they were volunteers, because this isn't a part of forest that was homesteaded. I have no idea what the apples are, and I was wondering once I have them, can I bring them up to your place and you can actually tell what they are?
not to put them on the spot, I would probably bring them to the Hausers. They have a lot more experience with iodine. When I find things in the woods, we forage apples for some of our ciders, and it's just how they taste. I never worry about what they're called, or if they might even be something different, because the apples are not true to the seed. So if they were just volunteers, they could be something that's similar to other varieties, but I would go either Hausers or Erickson's in Bayfield here and see what they say. They would have a lot more knowledge than me.
As long as you brought up cider, we had an email from Dan who wonders if you have some advice for somebody who wants to make cider.
For hard cider, you really don't need much. You can start with a 5-gallon bucket and a $2 airlock, and you can still make good cider. But a lot of it is just what kind of apples you're putting in there. You want to have a high sugar. You want to have something that has a little bit of that astringency where it dries out your mouth. Some acid in there. Otherwise, if it's mostly just sweet, it's going to be pretty plain when it ferments dry.
Yeah. So what are some varieties that work the best?
Around here, Cortland is actually a great one, which is a good all-around one. If you have crab apples in your area, too, throw some in there. They add so much to cider. And you can punch up some apples that may not be the best by throwing in some of those crab apples.
Oh, and Paul, what trees do best in our landscapes, do you think? That's another question.
Yes, a good question. I always think of native trees, but I do want to, think about flexibility. With the way the weather patterns have been, we are getting more erratic weather, but we're also getting a little bit warmer climate. And they've recently, I think a couple years ago, updated the USDA hardiness zone, which means that we did get a little bit warmer bands of planting opportunity up here. And so thinking about a little bit out of the box of bringing some things up to northern Wisconsin that would not be as conventional, things like maybe Kentucky coffee tree, ginkgo, things like sycamore, things like even river birch, which traditionally did not grow up here, depending on the site. I would think native, but thinking about some southerly distributed species could do quite okay in northern Wisconsin.
You know, I've had many horticulturists on over the last few years, and Kentucky coffee tree comes up all the time. What is it about the Kentucky coffee tree?
Well, I think the bark has a really interesting texture. It's kind of platy, it kind of sticks out a little bit, so it looks very unique. And then also, it's got a big, broad kind of architecture, big kind of open branches that are not that are stout, and so you can really see the architecture of that crown. So that's always attractive. And then these compound leaves, these long pinnate compound leaves, are really pretty. I think it's an attractive tree.
Well, you guys are attractive guests. Tell you that.
Thank
for
you.
Sure. Paul Segan, DNR forest and health specialist. He's working out of Hayward. Phil Brash, co-owner of Bayfield Winery and Blue Ox Cider. It's really a treat to have them with us. And, here I could sit and talk on the microphone and act like I know everything what I'm doing and that nobody else had anything to do with it. But that is very far from the truth. It takes a whole lot of people to bring you this live broadcast from Bayfield. And we want to thank our friends, especially at the Bayfield Chamber of Commerce. It was so nice of you to help us out. And the Old Rittenhouse Inn for their hospitality. Couldn't do this without the support of our Northern Regional Manager, Paul Donberg, and Senior Regional Manager, Lisa Nalbandian. Really helpful folks. Our technical directors, Tom Blaine, Tyler Ditter in Bayfield, Jeff Robbins, and Lee Rayburn in Madison. Clara Kniper took your calls today. She's here with her mother, as a matter of fact. And, of course, our executive producer is Jill Nadeau. Other WPR staff, Director Sarah Ashworth, of course, and regional managers Ezra Wall and Molly Gardner, Katie Lang, and other from underwriting, Diana Dudna, interim director of WPR News, Keely Baltina, and our marketing team. And, of course, we don't do it without you, our listeners. From Bayfield and Bloom, I'm Larry Mueller for Wisconsin Public Radio News. Thank you.